What an absolute pleasure. Thank you, as always, for your very, very precious time. We do appreciate it. Fantastic guest today. Dr. Rob Fowler, critical care doc at Sunnybrook. Here we go. Let's do the bio. This was a burger, it would have all the sides. The H. Barry Fairley Professor of Medicine, the Chief of Trauma and Critical Care at Sunnybrook, the past director for the Dalai Lama School of Public Health Institute of Health Policy, the past chair of the Canadian Critical Care Trials Group, the recipient of the Royal College Teasdale Corti Humanitarian Award. Let's get into that. That's good stuff for his work around SARS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, and Ebola. And you know what? He is here in lovely Edmonton today as the Dr. Professor Noel Gibney visiting speaker for Noel's Rounds. And you know what? I'm going to spend a moment and highlight my friend, mentor, Noel as well. It's said that one is supposed to look after one's mentors and teachers as part of the Hippocratic Oath. It's very easy when it's Dr. Noel Gibney, a huge presence here in Edmonton, educated in an island, educated at Harvard, became academic and clinical head at the U of A, and for Capital Health and Alberta Health after that, and a mentor to all. Somebody very interested in social justice and access to medicine and all the sorts of things we're going to talk about today. Rob, sorry for the long bio, but you're the one that earned all the accolades. Thanks for being here.
Thanks very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be in Edmonton.
Now, you're talking today about intensive care without borders, or soins intensifs sans frontières. You're a New Brunswicker. I'm going to guess, in addition to all those plaudits, you're also flawlessly bilingual as well. Is that true?
I wouldn't say flawlessly. I think any of my Francophone friends would point out the flaws pretty quickly.
My French was once described by Pierre Cardinal as enthusiastic but modest. I'm sure it's better than that. Let's get into things. What you up to right now?
Well, aside from being in Edmonton, I have a terrific role in Toronto working at Sunnybrook as a critical care physician, and have the pleasure of working with trauma, critical care, and burn colleagues there, helping to oversee and support and nurture a large program of caring for really sick people in Toronto.
Yes, you do. Let's start by talking about pandemics. We could take this in a dozen different directions. But in critical care in 2019, in October, just before COVID, you published a paper that we all read, Preparing ICU for the Next Pandemic, colon influenza. It turned out to be COVID or coronavirus. Prescient? I mean, you had done the work ahead of time. Were those lessons useful?
It was an interesting timing. This was coming up to 100 years of the H1N1 pandemic, the Spanish flu. And so I think it was on folks' minds that influenza, probably most likely, would be the next pandemic virus. People weren't suspecting another coronavirus like SARS, although anything is fair game these days. Looking at the history, just in very recent times, since we'll say 2002, 2003 with SARS getting hit with H1N1 just 7-8 years later, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome 3-4 years after that. You mentioned already Ebola, a whole other syndromic illness that took the attention of the world. And behind that, scary avian influenza that has circulated in many places of the world over the last couple of decades, leading into COVID, that consumed us like I think no one would really have imagined in 2019. As you mentioned, we put that piece out.
Well, you dropped the Ebola Easter egg there. Let's go after that. There is a wonderful video of you. I know you're a very modest guy, and in fact, you repeatedly described as a quiet advocate in this video, and it's a glorious compliment, I think. But let's talk about Ebola for a second. You'll notice this room, talk about a hot seat. This room is cooking right now. So sorry to simulate Ebola for you. But the lessons learned, because mortality went from, I don't know, 100% to 80% to 50% to 30%. And a lot of it was protocolization. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, I, in 2013... went to spend a year at the time at WHO, and the reason to take a year out of clinical care and to donate to WHO was on the experience of SARS and H1N1, and then circulating new coronavirus in the Middle East, with the notion that if we can better describe the illnesses that we're seeing very quickly, it will help clinicians and indeed public health around the world with the context and the calibration of response to what they're seeing. We've seen in other outbreaks, there's an often substantial lag time between when something emerges and when people can make sense of it to say, how bad is this? What does it mean for the area where it emerges? What does it mean for the rest of the world? And without some systematic way of describing that, it's difficult to get it right. And I think in any of the large global responses, there's ample criticism about not calibrating the response quite right or quickly enough. And so my time at WHO was supposed to be focused on MERS-CoV, and indeed we were able to, you know, help colleagues in the Gulf start a research program that continues to this day and has resulted in lots of observational work and clinical trials. But it was interrupted in the first parts of 2014 by Ebola, and the emergence of Ebola in West Africa, a place where, you know, Ebola had not been recognized before and was recognized, I would say, by astute clinicians that were sending samples to places that could test, surprisingly tested positive. And then already by that point, the virus had spread throughout a population that had not seen it before, and certainly with a public health and clinical infrastructure that wasn't prepared to deal with it, and very quickly became a local public health emergency that then proceeded to become a regional and global emergency in many ways other than name. And that time at WHO to focus on outbreaks that were respiratory in nature really ended up being completely focused on Ebola for about a year and a half.
Now, I've been reading a lot about disaster medicine recently. And I strongly encourage people to start with Neil Ferguson, not your colleague in Toronto, but the historian's book, Doom, where he points out that it's a lack of imagination, it's preparing for the last war, it's waiting for the perfect solution, and therefore you don't do anything in the meantime. But what was it with Ebola that dropped the mortality rate? Was it simply excellence in doing ordinary things? In other words, IV fluids, electrolytes, following the blood work rather than ignoring the blood work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question. The historical Ebola mortality sort of weighted across outbreaks by cases was in the ballpark of 70-80%. And I had not seen clinically a patient with Ebola before 2014, but like many of us sort of wondered, what is it about this virus that kills people? Is it that it naturally is just going to have a high likelihood of taking someone's life if you're infected, or is it because people can't get care that we might see every day in Edmonton or in Toronto or indeed around the world in well-resourced healthcare systems? And so a big part of our first efforts with the Ebola outbreak in caring for patients and in advocating for care was to characterize what people looked like, what they were dying from, not really well described or known before this West African outbreak. And is there anything, as you say, that we can do to prevent them from getting sicker? And I would say early on, discovered that people were looking critically ill from a multi-system disease perspective, weren't dying from hemorrhagic fever in the sense of losing lots of blood and having hemorrhagic shock, but were needing the sorts of care that we would deliver every day in acute wards, not necessarily critical care units, and indeed in critical care units. And so looking at trying to characterize the illness, taking blood work, doing volume assessments, preventing people from going into hypovolemic shock, correcting coagulopathies, correcting the occasional electrolyte disorder that might be life-threatening, and providing some kind of organ support that was feasible in the context of where most Ebola is. That could be oxygen, that could be intravenous fluids, it could be vasopressors. Occasionally, it was dialysis. And I think all of those things contributed. But as you describe the historical mortality dropping over time from 70-80% to 40% by the end of the West African outbreak, and indeed looking at patients that had the opportunity to be evacuated to well-resourced areas, Western Europe, the UK, and the United States, mortality in that relatively small population was about 18.5%. And so that's, if you want, kind of the opposite of where mortality started at the beginning of that outbreak, with really supportive care and very limited direct antiviral therapy, not enough to account for a drop in mortality. So the short answer to your question is, I think a lot of the impact comes from supportive care until people develop natural immunity and can clear the virus.
Well, and I think it's a brilliant take-home point, because there will be people entering our specialty because of the whiz-bangery of it, rather than excellence in just doing ordinary things and being vigilant, a word that's been used in Latin mottos for physicians for hundreds of years, and just being attentive. Now, all disasters are, to a degree, man-made, because they affect men and women and the population. What sort of thing, I mean, I'm a big believer that the human factor is always a factor. It's a social, cultural disease as much as anything, is it not? In the very same way that all of our diseases are social, culturally, as I sort of slowly segue us into access to healthcare and social justice issues. Presumably the same thing, no matter where you are on the planet, just a different phenotype.
Mm-hmm. I think with Ebola happening by and large in resource-challenged areas, in recently West Africa and Central Africa, you have all of the trappings of a challenge at caring for people from a public health perspective, and also from a clinical care perspective, where there may be interruptions in the opportunity for preventative care and primary care. Vaccinations, and we didn't mention this before, but over the last decade, there has been development and deployment of an effective Ebola vaccine. Still challenges at rolling that out in areas of need. When people do get sick, the infrastructure to prevent onward disease transmission in healthcare facilities and in the communities are challenged. And the opportunity to treat people, as we just described, to allow them to develop immunity and get better, all very challenged. And all of this speaks to certainly a global a challenge at providing equitable healthcare. That's nothing surprising to anybody, but it plays out quickly and dramatically when you have an outbreak like Ebola.
And certainly nothing surprising about it, but surprising and lamentable how we know that, but that's not where the energy is always focused. So let's, if it's not too awkward of a segue, let's talk about borders closer to home. Sans frontières medicine in Canada as well. I've heard it argued recently that we should make homelessness a diagnosis, because funding follows formal diagnoses, and often the person can't leave the hospital because they have no place to go to, and they came in because the straw broke the camel's back out in the community. Let's talk about equity, and you can take the discussion in any direction you wish. Noel was fascinated and engaged with trying to literally increase our bed base. And that's an issue in Canada. Our numbers aren't as impressive as we think they are. They may be very impressive compared to some of the low-resource places you've mentioned. But where do we go? I mean, how do we make sure that equity isn't just a buzzword thrown around for convenience?
It's such a big and challenging topic to address, certainly by...
That's why I ask the questions rather than answer them, Rob.
Certainly by clinicians who do inherently have a focus in caring for patients. I suppose a much broader level, thinking about how it is that we support populations. One debate is how much we put towards healthcare versus how much we put, for instance, towards education. And if you were able to take a very, very long game approach, outlasting electoral cycles, et cetera, and thinking about, if we were starting to help promote healthy lifestyles at a generational level, that would reap rewards decades and decades down the road. That's a difficult thing to, I think, turn healthcare spending into education spending, for instance, but I think it's a very important concept to consider. You alluded to all social determinants of health that are no less an issue in Canada than they are in other parts of the world. And we see this in the intensive care unit, our tip of the iceberg, where patients that are coming to us often have things that could have been prevented had they been caught earlier on, or are exacerbated because of a lack of preventative or primary care. and certainly exacerbated by their social circumstance around job security, food security, homelessness, etc. We see that, and I think bringing it up from an acute care perspective, a critical care perspective, and reflecting back to the population that we do see the consequences downstream of the things that don't exist in our population right now to support people, hugely important, and gets to areas where we don't commonly work, but are hugely important.
Yeah, bravo. Just one more question before I turn it over to Leon. You've also done a lot of work around end-of-life care and actually examining what patients and families want. I mean, it's interesting. We talk about difficulty getting into the system. There's a similar discussion about the sort of high-tech, low-touch medicine that we're offering people once they get into the system. Any comments on that small topic?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot more attention in the last decade to end-of-life care than maybe we had seen previously, certainly in our own specialty of critical care, and recognizing that our system, which I would say has been designed in Canadian Medicare as a narrow and deep system that focuses upon in-hospital care, where you can go and have all healthcare covered, is leading so many of us towards getting our care in hospital at the expense of a preference towards care outside of hospital. And we see this in patients that might say, before they get sick or even as they're getting sick, I'd prefer to die at home. But practically, even though that's clear, it can't happen in a way that's comfortable for patients or families because that resource isn't there broadly or deeply enough outside of the acute care system. And so you end up, as we see, patients that need support for analgesia, for symptom control, etc. And the only place that many people can get that is within a hospital by resources and attention. And so there's not an option for people to get the care that they would prefer, that they desire out of a hospital. And that's a system choice, of course. But it's one that, again, would think about shifting resource or adding resource to an area where we don't work, but where we see there could be benefit.
End of life care, not exactly the segue that I was hoping for.
Oh, thanks, my apologies. Peter,
but
yeah.
No, it's perhaps
work with it, Leon.
It may not a bad one. I want to steer it back a little bit to equity and equity specifically in critical care. I mean, especially if you consider pandemics. You know, we spoke about the very scary Ebola, what we saw in SARS-CoV-2, et cetera, et cetera. We have a vast geography in Canada. Like, how do we go about equity in critical care specifically? Is there some point where we just say, well, this is not feasible, we're not doing this?
Yeah, I think that there are Canadian specific challenges, being in a very large country, geographically huge, population well concentrated in the south, dispersed throughout the nation, and that puts certainly parts of our population, rural, remote, Indigenous communities, at risk. At risk when timely care is needed, and transportation and time of transportation can be critical for the kinds of illnesses that we see. So that's not a uniquely Canadian challenge, but it's certainly one that we experience as much as any place in the world. I think that is a difficult one, and I think that we aspire towards systems that can move people to healthcare when they need it. The reality is there are delays, and it's hard to level that inequity playing field. And that's just a reality. Within the context of I would say the Canadian South, if you want, where people aren't so far from healthcare, in COVID, we saw such a great example, unfortunately, of how different parts of the population demographically was at such higher risk. Included in that would be living conditions in terms of crowding, if you want, both in places of work and maybe even places of residence. Even after vaccination was available, huge differences in uptake, which were well recognized but difficult to penetrate in order to help protect people. And that speaks to, I would say, a challenge with any outbreak that at least I've been involved with, at controlling outbreaks end up being so much influenced by the degree to which you can connect with society and get society behind a plan that is medically sound and public health effective, which usually involves stopping disease transmission either through vaccination or appropriate sort of distancing, ways to prevent infection from passing one person to the next. And that requires a lot of social mobilization, a lot of social infrastructure in a pandemic response that sometimes comes late and is a very difficult one to solve in many countries.
What about non-pandemic times? I mean, off air a little bit earlier, you were referring to some innovation and so on. How do you see, what does the system look like in Canada to improve equity to critical care? You know, transport, telemedicine, is there anything coming down the pike? Anything, how do you envision it?
It's a great question. I think there are some technological innovations that we probably haven't stepped into too much in Canada. Telemedicine would be one. The U.S. certainly has stepped into it much more deeply. In visiting other places in the around the world, I've seen, for instance, a recent trip to India, my Indian colleagues providing overnight telemedicine services to large U.S. healthcare corporations, being able to directly interact with the nursing staff, being licensed in states, etc. We haven't done that in Canada yet. I think that there's a benefit there, certainly for remote regions, and that could be one thing that we do consider. Beyond the technology at reaching out, I think that it's important to continue to work on the ability to move people when they need to definitive care. Mm-hmm. And I think in all of our provinces, there's work to be done there.
And one of the examples that I recently saw is apparently in Australia, the outback, and I guess arguably they have more or less the same geographical issues that we might have in Canada. A lot of their highways actually is built to become a landing strip, and it actually has all the markings and everything on it, which I thought was really innovative and very interesting. Yeah, Peter?
That was certainly old school in this part of the country. They yeah. used to land on highways all the time. I don't know whether this is a poor segue at all, but I want to talk about frailty because it's something...
Work with it, Peter.
you're passionately involved in. John Muscadieri, Sean Bagshaw, Rob McDermott. There's lots of intensivists who've become involved in this multidisciplinary area. It's a big deal for Canada. It's a big deal for the Western world, if that's the term we use now. Where are things going? I mean, other than defining the problem, are we solving the problem?
I think, like end-of-life care in our field of critical care, frailty, with a lot of support from folks that you mentioned, has taken on an importance, recognized as a big contributing factor to both development of critical illness and the ability to respond and get better from critical illness over the last decade or so. You alluded at the very beginning of this session to Noel Gibney, and I was reviewing some of Noel's early work from decades ago, looking at older people. And
Noel's in the prime of his life, Rob.
Well, Noel was not older people when he did this work. But his work looking at how elderly people did in critical care compared to younger people, and looking at their outcomes. And working with Ken Rockwood, who was, you know, a giant in global frailty research, showing that, yes, people are more likely to get critically ill, more likely to die if you're older, not as much as we might have thought, and frailty being a big determinant of how they do afterwards. Recognizing that is important, but with a bit of a caveat that among survivors, when asked, do you enjoy your quality of life at this point? Knowing that you've passed through the filter of surviving and are here now, how do you consider your quality of life? And if I can paraphrase my take on some of that work, I would say maybe, surprisingly, a huge proportion of people, somewhat almost equal to those that were younger, said, no, I'm happy that I went through this and I have a good quality of life relative to what I consider, you know, good or bad right now. And so frailty important, but not to say that should be necessarily a defining feature of the receipt of critical care or not. A factor to speak to patients about, a factor to make sure people understand that it's going to be more challenging, that the outcomes may be worse, but to allow it as a part of the conversation that influences people's decisions well-informed about the challenges ahead, but not necessarily to presuppose in our minds that the care might not be helpful or to define the care that's offered.
And I think you've added wonderful nuance or included the wonderful nuance that took many years for that story to come to the fore. I mean, let's be honest, a history and physical still starts with this 84-year-old male, and you can almost hear the exhalation on the other end of the phone before they've heard anything. And the difference between physiologic age and chronologic age, or whatever terms we would now use, is a vitally important one. It's an ongoing debate for sure. Now, I can do this segue because it's so hot in this room. I feel like I may be febrile at this point. You're the co-principal investigator in the BALANCE trial on antibiotic duration. We've been enrollees. What can you tell us?
Yes, thanks for bringing that up. So the BALANCE trial, looking at shorter versus longer antibiotic therapy for a common condition, bacteremia, in critically ill patients. And we've just finished enrolling over 3,600 patients in 7 countries around the world. It's taken collaborators a long time with terrific efforts to get to this point. The trial finished enrollment this past summer. Queries database was locked in the latter part of 2023. Analyses have been ongoing for the last couple of months. We have a draft prepared and are getting it out to sites right now for their input. But we should hope to have an answer that we can share for peer review and the rest of the world within a couple of months.
Well, and the offer you just made of an exclusive reveal on this podcast, very much appreciated. Brilliant, Rob. Yeah. Very, very kind of you. So let's segue now into research in a bigger sense, because you were the past president of the Canadian Critical Care Society, Critical Care Research Group, that has led to the germination of many similar organizations around the world. You've done a lot of research. You've won patient safety awards. You know, it was Andrew Baker in Toronto that taught me about research that's doomed to succeed, sort of research that's done to fill a CV or to state the blindingly obvious that can't be turned down by a journal. Don't worry, I'm going somewhere with this. You have never performed this sort of research. I think you're very deliberate about how you spend your time and how you do your quiet advocacy. But how do we make sure, as a specialty, that we don't do research for the sake of doing research, that we do research that has an impact and doesn't even just have an impact at the bedside, because we all work in this cauldron and crucible of social, cultural equity issues. You know, there are 200 diseases or so in the world, and we only have treatments for about a quarter of them. So much of what we do is showing we care and supportive care. But how do we turn that into an academic impactful pursuit? Small questions today.
I think critical care in Canada indeed has been blessed for many decades of having a terrific base of clinicians that care for patients across the country and ask questions about how can we do this better. We've got a diverse group of people that engages, you've mentioned, in research, in quality improvement in patient safety, in teaching and education, in just terrific clinical care. And I think the questions that emerge along any of those lines of interest as we're caring for our patients are ones that can be approached in some way to make care better. I mentioned the spectrum, I would say, of duties that we are all collectively interested and engaged in, because research in and of itself, I think, is a critically important piece of what we do, but it's certainly just one of those pieces. Asking questions that are interesting to practitioners, to patients, to families, about common conditions that we might be able to make an impact on is the right starting point. And the emphasis maybe being on things that are interesting to people, meaning you will want to work on this even if you have many other options during the day, how to spend your time. So picking things that are of interest to you, I think, is a key starting point. Things that are relevant to your patients that you see every day makes it generalizable and practical. I think having a network of colleagues in Canada that have a combination of experience, enthusiasm, and real capacity within our critical care units to help both nurture these questions, evolve them to the point that you could say that's a bona fide research question that we can develop into a program to investigate how can we make care better. This is something that we do have in Canada to the credit of generations before us that allows us to often be able to succeed in large clinical trials. And I think the example of the Canadian Critical Care Trials Group over the last 35 years has been one that has worked well for a lot of other groups around the world. And I just feel so lucky to, have been part of this specialty during this era where we're blessed with a lot of interest, enthusiasm, and support.
Fantastic. And as we close, it's been a longer commute today. It's been a 401 highway commute today. But how do you keep yourself human, Rob? How do you keep yourself going? How do you re-energize yourself? And secondly, how do you avoid the gold medalist curse, as I heard it called? When you've done a heck of a lot of stuff, where do you go next? What do you do next?
Well, I certainly don't recognize that.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know. I love my job and all of the elements of it. I think having an ability to work within your field in a varied way, clinical care, at my own hospital, I really enjoy having the opportunity to conduct research with colleagues and do it yourself, I think is one of the ways that keeps me, if you want, fresh and engaged in our field. Being able to think about how can you improve the day for your patient, your family, your colleagues, etc. I get a lot of personal, if you want, benefit out of that every day. So I think, lots of things within our field that I think help to keep one fresh, engaged, and really satisfied with the work that we all do.
We're extremely lucky to have you both nationally and locally today. Leon?
Especially locally. Thank you so much for your time today. It was a delightful chat. We'll have you back for balance for sure. I'm just going to, it's 5 days, isn't it? 3 days.
It's 7 days.
I'm not getting anything.
1 day. Stay tuned.
None. No, we're done. Antibiotics out the door. Anyway, thanks for your time.
Information offered on the Critical Care Commute podcast and the resources available for download through the podcast and show notes is provided for general informational and educational purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the hosts, guests, or any individuals featured on this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the hosts or their employers.